Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Hi, and welcome to Teaching Transcendentally from the Outside In. I'm Tamara Banks Johnston.
And I'm Lydia Wolski Cholo.
So first, we're going to introduce ourselves and going to tell you why you're listening to us talk. I am a historian with a specialty in 20th century American history. I'm originally from Ponca City, Oklahoma, and my exposure to transcendentalism goes all the way back to 11th grade. So I'd like to say thank you to Mrs. Tatum for introducing kids in rural northern Oklahoma to Walden.
And I'm this is Lydia. I'm an American religious historian, and I'm actually from Bedford, Massachusetts, which is next to Concord, Massachusetts, and had absolutely no interest in the transcendentalists growing up. So this is a bit of a return. And I came to it through my studies of Unitarians in the 19th century and found my way back to those transcendentalists who were the pesky rebels in the ranks.
Nice. So how exactly did we land on this topic? And how would you think that each of us are outsiders?
So the first thing I can say is that I am not the hugest fan of Walden, which is sort of like saying that I'm not a fan of Pulp Fiction, which I'm not. And I know is,
yes,
shots fired. I tend to love his later essays, all of his quote unquote nature writings, meaning Henry David Thoreau, of course. But more to the point, I don't come to the study of transcendentalists or of Henry David Thoreau more specifically, which is who I'm focusing on most of all, as a literary scholar or a scholar of English. I'm trained in religious studies, in history as my discipline or my method, but even then more specifically, the history of Christian thought and American Christianities. So people don't tend to think of the transcendentalists and Henry David Thoreau, maybe even more especially, as those who would fit into the categories of American Christianities or Christian thought. And I beg to differ, but that's a different conversation. I sort of see them as a continuation of a lot of those New England religious threads. But I also don't get to teach that often about transcendentalists either, just based on my own work. And when I do, I'm usually coming at it from an angle that is not typical. I'm trying to parse and pull the context out of these pieces and enable my students to see sort of where the religious influences are and why we might think about them differently and in a different sort of critical lens. But I'm also cognizant of the ways that I'm an insider too, because I'm precisely the kind of person in the 19th century for whom transcendentalists were writing. I am a white lady who is educated and has the time to read and the leisure to read and doesn't necessarily have to think about the ways that my own privilege is impacted by what is being written. And so I see a lot of myself in them too. So all of this critique is with love and really about just me projecting my own social anxieties, I suppose.
Yeah, but I think, I mean, it's a great analysis. It's full disclosure, this area intimidates me and I'm still terrified. It feels very off limits. It feels elitist, and that's not to project anything onto the people who studied or gravitate towards it, but it feels very kind of protected, even in the region where it's still heavily celebrated. It's still the East Coast. It doesn't permeate to Oklahoma as much as you would think. But that exclusivity is one reason that I want to embrace it in the concept of, we know we're talking about teaching transcendentally. I want to not so much challenge the idea, but I want to provide access. Mm-hmm. Because as you said, even though they had these wonderful thoughts and these experiments at Brook Farm and Fruitlands, people still see it as something that's not accessible to everyday people. And they're not allowed to kind of play with these ideas because it feels that they don't have the leisure to just sort of go and read. But I too am an outsider because I am an historian. I am trained in 20th century history with a particular focus in beauty culture and politics and popular culture. So I could not be any more far removed from the study. So it's like, how did you find yourself here? I teach at a community college, so it's technical college, and we've really been embracing different forms of curriculum, and also, and especially in terms of textbooks and how do we get material to students that's cost effective and not prohibitive. So in embracing open educational resources, it really challenged me, A, to find more supplemental resources for students and confront some areas of history that I kind of run from and stray from. And I think it was very interesting that you stated that many people don't think of the Transcendentalists and Thoreau, especially in terms of American religion and Christianity. But if you look at historical textbooks, they're literally just thrown in religion reform, and that's it. They're like one brief chapter, wow, and you hardly mention them. So I think that's funny in your discipline. They're not really present. In mine, it's like, here's a bunch of stuff that people did that wasn't quite American in the middle of the 1800s, and we move on. So this is one thing I'm really trying to challenge the way I view accessibility in education, just because it seems like only certain people study something. It doesn't mean that everyone can have access. And I love to challenge the notion that it's not too highbrow for community college kids in Oklahoma City to study. I think we should empower our students and give them access and not make judgments about what they can handle or what they might be interested in. It is challenging in a survey course because you don't have time to share as much as you would like, but I can at least offer it to them and hopefully they will be encouraged to pick it up later.
And I love your point about access. And I think so much of what we're pointing to here is how the study of Transcendentalists is framed and how much that framing can impact just not just how they're situated in disciplines, but how the reader, and we're thinking of our students here, but the reader more broadly sees themselves as part of that readership. Right. Exactly. If they're framed as these 19th century brilliant white guys who had some things to say and some blind spots, and they speak to the East, and it's a kind of a parochial vision, there's so much that can be missed. And I think that really what Transcendentalists are, what they open up in many ways, is what they hoped to be, which was this realization of the divine in the self and in everybody else. And the unintended effect is, of course, that their works are intimidating to people, and they get they get kind of vaunted onto a pedestal, and only a few people get focused on. There's so many other Transcendentalists. Right. Yeah, it's Emerson and Thoreau and
that's it.
And there's so many more people to dig into. And I think that they would have been really disappointed at the idea that they're only being read by in a certain light or by a certain kind of person. I think that they hoped in their writing to reach more.
It's so interesting that you say that, because it seems like they're only relegated to one particular area. It can't be religion, it can't be history. They're literary giants, and that's it. And it's like, when you take them out of context, you miss so much of the depth and of the beauty that's there. The fact that we don't look at, well, he's writing Walden, but what's going on? What's the context, the historical context, right, that's going on? And the fact that we literally separate them from some of the other work, and we just put them in this pigeonhole in a vacuum, it separates and it takes away a lot of their relevance and the true power of their work, I would think.
Yes, I totally agree. So our first segment is, and I think we've already started sort of alluding to this a little bit, is, mm-hmm, defining what exactly we mean by teaching transcendentally from the outside in, and just generally. Tamara, how would you define teaching transcendentally?
Oh, Lydia. the question that's very scary that I knew was coming. I'm still refining that definition of what does it mean to me? What does the word mean? And I know that seems so kind of highbrow, like it's avoiding the answer. But I like to think my work in teaching transcendentally is just presenting actual historical figures as people and discussing their actions in historical context. Again, I really think that part of access to knowledge is part of what it is, not making decisions on what people can handle. I mean, obviously, Margaret Fuller might be a bit challenging for a student just coming out of high school, but we can break things down and make it digestible. And we can work with the context of, you know, the fact that she's writing and she led this seemingly unconventional life that the majority of women weren't living in the 1800s, even wealthier women, that she's in these circles. So that's part of it. Again, like I said, it just still seems like it's centered in a very particular group in the East Coast. And how can we make sure that, you know, kids in our local home or even ranchers in Wyoming, that everyone can really enjoy what's being written and what's being shared. And it's not just being parsed and parceled in these kind of little particular pockets of education.
Right. Yeah, I always think of transcendentalism as sort of, it's such a big movement and it encompasses a lot of different kinds of impulses, the reformatory, the intellectual, the theological. But overall, there's sort of like a few hubs and one is the idea that conformity is death, right? That to not pursue truth because it might cause you to step out of line is anathema. You always need to keep growing and keep thinking. And even that means conformity to the self, conformity to an earlier version of yourself. A lot of that comes from actually Unitarianism, or the notion of self culture, which is the idea that to know the mind of God, you need to continually be culturing your mind, right? And a lot of that comes from sort of study and reading, which once again is located in a particular privileged class understanding of what self-culture is. But the message is clear for transcendentalists, which is growth is the end, right? You need to keep growing. And that accompanies the second hub, which is sort of the trust of the self in your own intuition, your own reason, big R. And so for me, teaching transcendentally is really about pushing students and myself to destabilize my assumptions and their assumptions, and to push back or push against the idea that we need to see in black and white more often than not, including the figures that we're studying, transcendentalists, they are gray, they are muddy. And that makes them so much more interesting and so much more
relatable.
Right. And, you know, and we're going to talk about our assignments, I know, very soon, but this links so much to what I do a lot of in my religious studies work, where I teach a lot about new religious movements or quote unquote cults. And my students all come in with the idea that cult equals bad. And we spend the entire course gradually kind of unpacking what we mean by that word and what we mean by these people, and that they are not either or, they are not bad or good. They are bad and good, like all people. And so I think for me, teaching transcendentally comes into a lot of my courses, because anytime you are compelling yourself to learn and break with a past understanding or a past presupposition, you are engaging with that transcendentalist ethos. And you're also trusting yourself to be self-critical, which is really hard.
Exceptionally hard, and something that people don't do enough of.
Right. Yes. And I include myself in that category of student too. I am constantly being schooled in ways that I can learn and critique and grow.
It's important though, especially when you're doing this type of work. I think we do have a responsibility as scholars, but also just people. You know, that sounds really touchy-feely, too good, but it's true. It's just the basic essence. It's like, if you can't do that, then you really should rethink why you're attracted to this type of work.
Right, right.
So you mentioned some of our lessons that we're going to do. How do you teach it, or what practically, like what lessons do you have your students engage in?
So in my current course right now, I'm co-teaching an honors course with a colleague in my university's English department, actually. And we both engage with subjects related to nature and wilderness. And we're doing a unit on conceptions of wilderness and their relationship to BIPOC people, and so to specifically to Indigenous peoples and to Black Americans. But the place where I've brought in Thoreau is, of course, he travels to the Maine woods, and on these three sort of separate occasions, one to Katahdin in I think it's 1847. One to Chesuncook in 1853, and then up the Allegash and East Branch rivers in 1857. And these are part of his sort of his travel writings and his excursion writings. And it's one of my favorite pieces because there's all of these fantastic passages that we can look at that are so ripe with religious iconography, but they're also a fascinating study in a white tourist engaging with Indigenous peoples and who he believes kind of are there as resources for him. And you see sort of a gradual arc in his own understanding of who these people are. And that comes out in practical and historical ways where he didn't want to publish his last piece because he was afraid that his guide, Joe Polis, would read it and be really upset. So you see sort of a self-awareness grow. But the reason I give my students this text to read, and then I accompany it with a piece by Joshua David Bellin called In the Company of Savages, which talks about Thoreau's real steeping in ethnographic and ethnologic racism of the 19th century, specifically via Henry Rowe Schoolcraft and Lewis Henry Morgan, who were at the forefront of this new anthropology, which was sort of built on a belief in the hierarchy of race. And it led to a lot of these interpretations or assumptions as to who got to live, who was going to win the history battle, the civilization battle. And spoiler alert, it wasn't Indigenous people in their view. And so I give the students the Maine woods, and really what we try to do is a couple of things. We were first trying to sort of understand the mindset of the 19th century white tourist via Thoreau, who is this, you know, beloved figure. I love him in many, many ways. And for that reason, I'm very critical of him in this moment. But then the second half of it is also to see if we can find the Penobscot looking back. Like, what do they think of this kind of project, of this person who's really trying to seek salvation from them, right? He wants to return to this primal sense of wilderness and wildness, but he doesn't want to stay there. He wants to get as close as possible, which to him is getting close to the Penobscot, right? Who he's cast as these sort of primitive peoples. And we take these texts together. They come to class having read them. And what I did in the specific class was I split them up into groups, and I had each of them take one of the three travel narratives, and they each had to find one passage that they thought encapsulated Thoreau's gaze on the Penobscot, and one passage that they thought encapsulated the Penobscot gaze on Thoreau. And what they came up with was really fascinating. They were very critical of Thoreau. And of course, then my immediate response is to be like, okay, let's nuance this, when I, of course, set that up for them to be critical. But then they came up with all these amazing passages about the Penobscot, and what we can actually learn about what they're seeing, and these moments of real misses for Thoreau, where they're offering him mythology and he's just talking about how they're droning on. And so it ended up being this really seminal moment of conversation, where they were learning in the moment kind of how to read through the lines, while also seeing in real life how a figure who is so beloved, so lionized, can be, you know, a participant in these racist discourses and really imbibe them, and not see that what he's doing is settler colonist, right? He's hoping for their extinction at the same time that he's hoping to get something from them.
It's sometimes it can be very tricky to introduce students to those types of conversations. And I don't know if you find this, but it seems sometimes everyone wants to jump on and just say all the reasons it was bad or he shouldn't have done this. And you try to get, as you said, that nuance. And then right. It gets trickier. And it's like, things aren't always good or bad. We have to really look. And it's like, what did he think of what he was doing? It's right. Not excusing behavior, but getting students to participate. And do you ever find that they have uncomfortable moments, so that they're kind of met with hesitation? I know I do at times. So I'm just wondering how your students...
Yes, because, you know, and some of this is a totally understandable urge to say the right thing. And I mean that both in the context of the classroom, which is, you know, they're in a space where there's a power dynamic going on, but also say the right thing in an ethical and social justice sense, you know, so they're so attuned to these narratives and discourses that I certainly was not when I was a freshman. Because these are all freshmen. and so they're really aware of that. And so it's a really powerful moment when you can see them doing the both and kind of thinking, which is what I always say to my students. I'm like, it's both and. Let's get to the both and. Can Thoreau be both a brilliant proto-ecologist who contributed so much to understanding of the natural world? And can he be racist? And the answer is yes, he can be. And it doesn't mean that we have to stop studying his work. It just means that we have to accept that he has blind spots like everybody else, and we do a disservice. But you hit the nail on the head, which is that it's easy for me to stand here and say, yes, it's this. And it takes a while to grapple with the idea that you can hold these, both of these things together. They can both be true. It's going to hurt your little head not for them to resolve, but that's okay. That discomfort's okay.
I run into that in history all the time. Especially, I love the fact that you use the word lionize, because we deify people. And I don't try to strip them back down to earth, but it's like they literally were flesh like we are. And it's incredibly difficult. I find especially the challenge with some of the transcendentalists is because we don't look at them historically, overwhelmingly. They're kind of in this literary field. And as you said, even religiously, I don't remember them as a big part of any of my history education in grad school or undergrad. And I really only remember in English, again, Mrs. Tatum with her gateway piece, you know, Walden, which you shared earlier, your personal non-preference for. No, but it was one of the things I remember. It was kind of overwhelming because she had us actually have our own Walden experience. She wanted us to read and go write in nature. And I can't imagine assigning students to do that, because they'd be like, why am I doing this? So I try to take a small kind of micro step, if you will. I absolutely love primary sources. So instead of just having them read newspaper articles and speeches, I'm actually going to have one of the assignments that I'm introducing this semester is they're going to read A Plea for Captain John Brown. I want to put them back in the historical narrative, and especially the work that they're doing, the work that they did when they were alive. I wonder if it's almost by design that they're separated from that. We don't talk about them and the transcendentalists being a part of these major anti-slavery movements and societies. And I know someone will hear this and be like, but I do. And congratulations. I sincerely mean that to the few of you that are doing that. But overwhelmingly, that isn't happening. And I wonder why we take them out of the narrative, or when they are put in the narrative, it's attached to just religion and reform as a bunch of things that a few people did. For about 10 minutes in the 1840s through the 1860s, and they stopped and they went to consumption after the war. And how can we get them back? And how can we talk about other people? How can we look at Elizabeth Peabody and the work that she did? How can we give Louisa May Alcott her due? We talk about Bronson. How can we kind of pay homage to some other people? So that's what I try to do in a very small scale. But I think the answer that I like to settle as we don't talk about them, because some of the people they're connected with are historically, quote unquote, problematic. And you don't want to talk about them because, well, we know what John Brown did. And so how can you put these people that have been lionized next to people who we think had a problematic reaction, even though they were attempting to do something for the right reason? And it's not easy. And it gets messy when we talk about some of these things in history. But in my African-American history class, I want to definitely put them back into the narrative, as well as talking about some of the other, I refer to kind of by transcendentalists by proxy, especially like William and Ellen Craft, and looking at Lewis Hayden and some of these other people that are around those movements, and putting them back geographically in their time, historically in context, and really opening up larger conversations and bringing more people into this work, hopefully, by making those connections that aren't obvious, because they certainly don't match up. You can read a few things in Civil Disobedience and a lot of the other works, but until you really sit down and you see the actual connection and the work that they were doing at the time, it's like, wow, we really do them a disservice to what they were attempting to do, for all their flaws and everything, all the privilege that they had that they weren't aware of. The fact that they were really trying to live up to the convictions is something that we need to just honor in giving a true picture of the actual person. That's something that we have to do in history. They're not good. They're not bad. They're people. And we need to talk about what they did and their actions. It's not easy, but it's definitely something that I'm trying to do, and open up history so it's not just these pockets of presidents and war generals. It's all sorts of people making all kinds of decisions that brought us to this now moment. And we'll see. I mean, there are hits and misses. Some semesters things work. So I'm hoping A Plea for Captain John Brown. Well, sorry, Mrs. Tatum, I couldn't do Walden. As much as, again, everyone loves the piece, it's the gateway piece. It's the first piece you're all introduced to. But I wanted to go a little bit left. And I thought, I will say, I was like, how do I really explain another kind of gateway piece is Emerson's American Scholar. I was like, we're not going to quite go there yet. Maybe in another semester, I'll be brave enough to try, but we will start simple and we'll work our way from there.
Well, I love that phrase you use, transcendentalist by proxy, because it opens the door to including so many people that wouldn't even bear the name transcendentalist, or, I know there's sort of like the major and the minor transcendentalist, but what you're pointing to is really kind of what this podcast is about, which is, what does it do to teach transcendentally, but also to think and act and write transcendentally? Can you have transcendentalists who are taking so many of the ideas and the themes and questions of these works and bringing them into their own disciplines, their own lives, their own activism? And I think that's certainly true. And we do ourselves in our respective fields a disservice if we don't expand the scope and the lens.
Absolutely.
I love that. And I also think that there should be history classes on transcendentalists. I think that's such a good point. And I mean, I didn't even think about that. That didn't even register with me that the only context I've ever talked about transcendentalists has been in English classes in high school, and then in courses on American religion.
It never made sense to me. And it's one of those things that didn't make sense, that I thought something was wrong with me. How come we weren't teaching, especially literature? And I think it's because at the time I was in Honors 11 and AP History in the 11th grade. And we would have to read these pieces And then we wouldn't talk about the context in which they were written. I mean, you're not writing The Crucible just because everything is great in the 1950s. So why we don't pair it up to really give people this truly well-rounded perspective so they better understand the context. I'm sure that there are literary scholars who said, there are reasons we don't do that. Again, please be gentle. I'm not a literary scholar. And I would open a dialogue with that so I could learn more. But I always wondered why we just kind of put them off in this pedestal and we don't sully them with anything else. It feels like it's trying to protect their image. And it just, when you realize what they truly were doing. And some of it is just mind-blowingly revolutionary, even with all the privilege that they had, the fact that they still were willing to utilize it to whatever scope for some of these causes, and they truly tried to live their beliefs. It needs to be, I think, to be better framed to let people know. It's like, yeah, they were really trying to do some big stuff. So
right. It's
good times. It's hopefully, maybe you can start a petition and we will get thing transcendental history taught. We'll work on that.
I love it. We'll start stumping now.
We'll start, yes. Coming to fall 2023. No, just kidding.
And I also think that there's something to be said for the power of having so many different interpretations that might be diametrically opposed, you know. And when I talk about transcendentalists and Henry David Thoreau and theology, right? That is, theology is a four-letter word for some, and I kind of love that. And I don't mean that in a provocative way. I love that I can read it and see something because of my discipline, and you can see something and see something because of your discipline, and others can. And all it does is just highlight how rich these texts are and how cool it is that you can take these thinkers and their work and bring them into light into so many different ways, and not always in positive ways and very critical ways. But that's what's great. That's what's great about texts that live on and have such an afterlife as these do, is that they shouldn't stay frozen in time as good and untouchable canon.
Absolutely, right, because they're literally these living documents, and people can read them in their own time and make connections with them. It's like, wow, like this speaks to me. I understand what this person is trying to say, and the fact that they can grapple with it. And it's almost comforting to be like, okay, so humans have always been a little bit messy. And it's not that we're getting everything wrong today, as we love to be told. It's like they were dealing with the same emotions that, you know, we are now. And so it does help this human connection through time and history. And it's like, that's what they're supposed to do. And hopefully they would be proud that, you know, they're still people focusing on what they do. I think they would be.
Right. Right. And that Ralph Waldo Emerson can make mistakes just like you.
Yes, exactly. It's like, I'm going to be okay. Like, it's going to be all right.
Right. But we're all fine. Everything's fine.
We're great. But no, it's interesting. I think kind of one of the last pieces I wanted to share, something I always find interesting, is how you see them trickle into pop culture, but not really. And even the areas they trickle in. As I shared with you and were preparing for this, I received an ad for a tea that's literally named Civil Disobedience, because the person at this company, and this isn't a plug, we're not going to mention the name, but the person at this company grew up in New England. And so they felt this connection because they had a parent who really enjoyed the works of Thoreau. And so they literally named this tea after, you know, one of his works. And it's like, people seem to feel a connection, but then they don't at the same time. And I wonder what that means, is you can say things in circles and kind of get a rise, but then it doesn't get much deeper than that. And so I wonder what that speaks to. Does it still feel like it's this highbrow kind of wink? If you know, you know, and if you don't, you're not in this exclusive club, and it doesn't go much deeper than that. Am I overthinking pop culture too much? Possibly so. It's what I like to focus on academically, but I don't know. I'm just curious on what your takes are when you see the transcendentalists outside of sort of academic disciplines.
Right. I'm still waiting for that Henry David Thoreau biopic, and it's just not yet.
It's going to come.
It's going to come.
Timothy Chalamet will put on a wig and a beard.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, yes. I love that. I'm already picturing it.
There you go.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's so interesting that on the one hand, we're sort of talking about the how compartmentalized transcendentalists can be, and yet they also live at like a molecular level culturally. And everyone knows a little, it's like one of those things that everyone knows a little bit about, right? They've heard of it. They've maybe heard the title. Maybe they've read a piece of it, but they can't remember what it's about. Who knows? And that's, I think that that's a common thing that can happen in the United States, especially in the age that we live in, where we can consume and make a product out of anything. But it also, I think what's so notable about your sort of story about this tea is that very clearly that tea, or the name of the tea, Civil Disobedience, it came about because the company owners did feel a connection to this story. And so they clearly have their own reasons for naming it. And they have maybe gone deeper with it. And so the conversation that they're opening up is, are people going to drink this tea and then get curious and maybe look a little bit? And so I think that there's, you can, once again, going back to this, nothing is black and white. We can see it both ways. We can see this as, oh God, it's just everywhere. And now we're never going to be able to, you know, dig into those deeper levels because everyone just sort of has this monocultural understanding of it. Or is it getting to the place where people might pick this up and go, huh, what's this about? What's this story? And that's really interesting. That's provocative. Maybe that will bring some people into the conversation who wouldn't have been in it to begin with.
Hopefully. I mean, I was brave enough to challenge my own fears of transcendentalism, and that's how I wound up with a lovely group of people in Concord last summer, which is such an adorable town. I'm not gonna lie, I miss the cheese shop. I miss their chicken salad sandwich. It was a delightful place. It was just, I wish everyone could not necessarily go there, but to just have that experience of being challenged, but being challenged in a safe space, because it didn't feel judgmental. It's like, okay, I can come to something where I feel like an outsider, a complete imposter, and engage in dialogue around some of these really challenging concepts and kind of really make sure that I'm being critical of my own perceptions. And why do I feel like I don't have access? Why do I feel like an imposter? Why do I feel like, because I'm not a literary scholar, that I don't have a voice in discussing kind of what I'm reading and interpreting? So hopefully I share your optimism, hoping that others will come to the table and embrace the transcendentalist as I am continuing to do so, as I continue to read and find new discoveries and new appreciations of things that at one point would have felt out of bounds, like, nope, not for me, nothing to do. And just because it's not my main discipline doesn't mean that I can't enrich the way I look at other things through that sort of those perceptions that they have. So yeah, it's been a journey, and it will continue to be one, but I'm happy to go along with it right now.
Well, and that's not to be totally precious about it, but that's totally transcendental, right?
You know what? Full circle. We have come full circle.
We're all on that canoe going down that river, and really, we're just going to see what's around the next bend. And maybe for me, it will even be liking Walden more. Who knows?
You know, Mrs. Tatum doesn't even know you, but I'm sure you would do her well. I should really thank her for that. I've never thanked her. So like, you know what? You thought a group of kids in rural Northern Oklahoma can not only read this, but understand. And kudos to her, that takes a true teacher who's willing to not prejudge her student. Even though her honor is 11, there's no expectation that sort of, you know, again, that Tony highbrow sort of literature would have graced our desk. So yeah. I want to continue in that tradition and just, you know, sharing it again, not trying to be too transcendental, but again, I definitely love the fact that we're able to have these kind of conversations and bring more people along. So good times.
Well, likewise, Tamara, it's been a total pleasure.
Absolutely, Lydia. So I've had a really good time, so it's been fun. So thank you all for listening. Signing off, I am Tamara Banks Johnston.
And I'm Lydia Wolski-Cholo. We wish you all well. We did it.